you know, repeating the plot.
And the day I got chased across the top of the hill, this was the day before Pegasus started. It must have been the last day of March, because Pegasus started on April 1st. And as I said, the other three line companies moved off the hill and over to Assault 471. Well, Bravo was going to be left behind to maintain that perimeter because we were to turn the hill over to the cab. And we maintained a perimeter only on the hilltop itself. Where Alpha and Charlie were, we just left that open and secured the area where the two areas were connected. But Captain Williams, in his infinite wisdom, decided on the afternoon before that started that we had best go over to Delta's area and inspect their lines so we'd know what we were going to do the next morning, because it was going to have to be a coordinated move out of them and a move in of us. And of course, spreading one company over where two had been, we were going to be more thinly spread through there, and we wanted to know where we were without having to decide that in the dark. And I agreed with his philosophy of doing this. The only thing was that he wanted to take a radio operator along with him, because he didn't want to be isolated, even though he was going to be right there in the midst of Delta. And the only way to get to Delta was to either go down to our lines and go around the hill, or to just go over the bald top of that hill. And that's the top of the hill, and that's how bald it was. And when you stood on the top of that thing, you could be seen. And so he insisted that I take the radio and go on over there, and he would follow. And I started out across the hilltop, and I thought, I shouldn't be doing this. And I got a third of the way across it, maybe. And the total distance from our position across the top of the hill was probably 60, 70 yards, somewhere in that area. And I guess I should have just got the radio on and run across there. But things had been fairly quiet up to that time. I got about a third of the way across there, and a mortar round landed back behind me. And I just thought to myself then, I'm in trouble. And I figured what was going to happen was he was going to adjust, and the next one had come down on me. And I knew that I had to do something, and I took off running. And I don't remember where the second one landed. I think it landed behind me too. But and I hit the ground when the second one landed, and then I got up and I made it all the way to Delta's trench line, and then the third round landed, and it was where I had been on the ground. And I just ran for the first bunker I saw and just dove into it, and it was a platoon leader's bunker. So this lieutenant was surprised when I jumped in on him. But I didn't make any foolish mistakes like that one again. So these pictures here, this is a fellow that was one of our radio operators who liked to draw, and somehow he got a tablet of paper up there. And I don't know how, because...
What was it in? Do you know?
It's probably on the back of that picture.
We might be able to, if some of those drawings got to the historical center, we can look them up.
This guy was in at Lejeune in the 2nd Division at the... I don't think that's going to come off of there. No.
Well, don't ruin it.
He was in 2nd Division.
Did you see anything there? Were they caricatures or...
No, he's just...
Realistic?
They were realistic. He sketched tanks and bunkers and a few people. And he was pretty good, too. And it was just a hobby with him. He was in 2nd Marine Division when Arab-Israeli War broke out in 67. And he was telling me about some of the things the 2nd Division did in getting ready for that. But he was a really intelligent fellow and interesting to talk to. These are our other two radio operators right here. And this was a can of, it was like creamed beef was what it was. And We got a can of that good old Derry's meat sauce. You remember that stuff in the mess halls? I'm surprised. Maybe the officers didn't have that in their mess halls. We did, though.
I don't remember the brand.
It was kind of a brown-looking tin sauce in a bottle. And this was when they first brought some of the bee rations up there, and we thought, boy, we'll just fix this stuff up, you know, and it'll be a great change of pace. We built that fire and put that can on it, and Roger, I think his name was Roger Williams, he thought this would make a great combat photo to be stirring it with a bayonet. Well, I tell you, a bayonet makes a lousy spoon, and that stuff burned in the bottom of that can and ruined the whole can. This is the trench line here. This thing goes on over to the company CP, and this is our bunker, and here's our facility back here, and that's our FO's bunker right there. He had a fantastic bunker built for an FO because the thing was dug down deep enough, and he had, this is probably 6 feet long across here, long enough to sleep in laying down. But the whole front was open just about like that, and he just stood in the bunker to call in any fire that he wanted to. He faced Quezonville down there. And here's looking at it from the opposite direction. This is a trench going to our bunker right here, and this is two of our platoon leaders right here going into the company CP. And you can see how the hill falls off just on the other side of the CP. And Quezonville is tucked down in these trees down here. And then the combat base is back over here. And you can see how foggy it was there. That's me just sitting there reading a letter from home. And this is the three radio operators right here. And me. Here's our FO. He was outside his bunker then. And here's Quezon combat base here. Now this picture is still Quezon. But this is on Pegasus. Shore's book really ends too soon because there was a lot more that happened at Quezon after he cuts it off. This is on top of that hill, 552, I believe it was, and this is the same bomb crater. That's a 500-pound bomb crater that we're in there. Gives you some idea of what a 500-pound bomb will do coming down from B-52.
Could you say something about Quezon after Shore's book ends?
Well, yes. I wanted to tell you about the Arclight mission up there in the B-52s. Those things seem to always come at night. I don't recall one during the day. You'd never hear the B-52s. All you'd hear are those bombs coming down, and they just made this combination of howling and screeching sound. And you never knew where they were going to come down. And on one mission in particular, down in front of what I understood was the FOB lines, and I don't know what FOB stands for, but that's what we call them. They were Vietnamese, or they were what the other native people, the Mountain Yards. They were Mountain Yard tribesmen or something with special forces people in charge of them. But they had B-52 missions there that I think were within about 600 or 700 yards of the wire. But you'd hear those bombs coming down, and then there'd just be a line of orange flashes walk up and down the hills, and you'd just see them off in the distance, and they were actually pretty to watch. We had quite a lot of them up there. And then you'd have the TPQs, this one or two planes that had come over, and you'd hear them come over, you'd never hear the bombs coming down because they were at much lower altitude, but all of a sudden the bomb would detonate somewhere. Another thing you'd see at night was the photo reconnaissance planes for making maps. And I don't know what kind of flashbulb they had on those planes that they used to take the pictures with to make the maps from, but that was one powerful flashbulb. This is from 552.
Did you ever see this Puff the Magic Dragon?
Oh, yes.
If so, would you describe it?
I don't recall seeing Puff at Quezon. I may have been asleep when he was there, but we used Puff on many other occasions after Quezon.
Could you just describe it in general?
You never would see the plane, but you'd hear it because it was an old piston-driven plane, and I don't know if it was a C-47 or what it was, but Puff had red tracers, and instead of orange, and I had heard that Puff was both 20 millimeter and 7.62, and 7.62 tracers were orange, so maybe it was 20 millimeter they were firing. But that thing fired so fast that all you'd hear is this loud buzz. And the light from the tracers would always precede the buzz. And it was strange because it'd be a perfectly black sky, and then all of a sudden this red line would start from nowhere and go down to the ground. And about halfway down to the ground, then you'd hear the buzz. And then the red line would mysteriously stop. And halfway down to the ground, the buzz would stop. And it was a tremendous weapon.
Why?
Because it put out so many rounds, and once you had a Puff on station, you wouldn't have any problems as long as the Puff was there. We have one operation we went on where it was right up near the Benhai River. In fact, it was the last operation I went on before I rotated, and we had a CH-46 go down in the LZ because of mechanical problems, and they flew in some people to get the thing fixed and fly it out of there, and it turned out they couldn't. They brought a Puff in on station when it got dark, and they just circled that chopper with fire, and the Puff had to leave when he ran out of ammo, and I guess when he was running out of gas. And so they got the idea that they'd just call in 8-inch fire around the thing. And I don't know who called in the fire, but after they had kept that Puff there until he expended all his ammunition and all his fuel, the first round from the 8-inch blew that 46 to a million little pieces. So, but it was a comforting feeling when you had Puff there. This is our hill as the NVA must have seen it, because this is looking from, I use the number 552. I don't know if it was 552 or not, but let me show you on the map where it was. If I can find the map. There's a map here that shows 689. I think this is 689 here. This is the hill that we were on back here. There's a saddle that runs between these two. We were going to go over on this hill, but it just wasn't big enough to hold all four companies, so we stayed over here. Bravo Company did, and Alpha Charlie and Delta were on the other hill. And we were on that hill probably a week, maybe 10 days. And this is the hill. This is the saddle running through here. 689 is over here.
This is during Operation Pegasus?
This is Pegasus. And we moved over to that hill probably 3rd, 4th, somewhere around there. And we didn't encounter any resistance going from our hill over there. And it was a heck of a climb up that hill. I remember that. There was a stream running at the bottom of that hill. When we first got to Quezon, some of our FOs spotted elephants that the NVA were using to transport supplies. And I believe there was a battery of four deuce mortars in Quezon proper. And because I recall somebody making the comment that it was a four deuce that hit him. It hit him right on his rear end, and the elephant just kind of staggered off. And we never saw him after that. There's a conclusion to that story. We went down to this stream and found a decent pool where we could all bathe. And this is the first bath that I had in 3 months right here. When we got through bathing, we moved up this stream just a little ways before we came back up the hill. And we found the dead elephant. He was upstream from where we had been bathing. So. But he was there. And our whole purpose here was to assist in the clearing operation. And we cleared. What we did was operate west of that hill line to clear there. And I really think what had happened at that point is the NVA were pulling out of there and they had left a rear guard. Bravo was fortunate enough, and I use that word because I sincerely mean fortunate enough, that we didn't run into any organized NVA resistance. We found things like this. Bangalore torpedoes made out of bamboo and filled with blocks of TNT, and here's a Russian helmet laying here, and cases upon cases of ammunition. And we found a lot of grave markers, too, where NVA had been killed. Little pieces of aluminum where they'd taken a nail or a bullet or something and tapped out the name and the date of death. And we didn't bother to dig up any of them. We weren't that concerned about it.
Well, could you describe the graves and remains just a bit more?
Oh, most of the time it'd just be a little mound of loose dirt there. And this grave marker stuck in at the top of it. And I guess there would be some reason on the NVA's part to leave those behind to make us think that they had suffered a lot of casualties when in fact they hadn't. But my own belief is that they actually did suffer the casualties and just couldn't move the bodies out of there. I talked to a fellow much later who operated in Laos on some clandestine basis. And he said that they had a lot of NVA hospitals in Laos, and that the B-52s had really torn them up bad. You can imagine when you see a bomb crater, that 500-pound bomb, what kind of bunker you have to withstand something like that.
Did you ever walk through the remains of a B-52 raid airplane?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Could you describe it?
Well, you saw the size of that crater, and those craters would be staggered. Just one after the other like that, and that might go on for 1,000 yards or more, depending upon how many bombs he had with him. And at the angle of the crater, anything that was in the path of that shrapnel from that bomb when it came out would be gone. Trees that were there would either be just cut off at an angle right there, or the larger ones would just be stripped clean of bark and leaves and small limbs and everything. Tremendously destructive. The caisson was actually a pretty place when we got there. It was a beautiful valley. And when we left, it was a mess.
Could you say something more about that?
The beauty of the place?
Mm-hmm.
There are an awful lot of places in Vietnam. I got some other pictures here of places that were truly beautiful when we got there. But I don't know if I've got any in here that you can see the B-52 stripes and case on. It'd have to be a long-range shot if it was. But I've got some elsewhere that are very similar to there that I'll show you.
What about the psychological effects of the B-52 raids? Do you have any
thoughts on them?
On both?
Well, I think they had to be tremendously demoralizing for the NVA. How could the NVA combat the B-52 strikes? They didn't know when they were coming. They didn't know where they were coming. The only warning you had was the sound of the bombs coming down. For us, when you can stand there at night and see a whole hillside erupt in fire and know that you can have that whenever you need it, it's great for our spirits. We had those, we had the TPQs, we had the artillery in caisson proper, we had the 175s at Camp Carroll that fired in support of us. I didn't really have a feeling that that we were in, DMV and food too. That was a topic a lot of times, particularly when the anniversary came around and everybody was told that it was the anniversary of it, and we were expecting a big assault. Now, I will say that when the NBA hit Long Bay, I heard, not everybody did, I enjoyed being a radio operator because I was able to always know what was happening and being right there in the command group, particularly after I went back to the tag, and I would know before the CO knew what was happening. But we had an intelligence report that they were going to hit Long Bay, and sure enough, they hit Long Bay.
And could you describe a little bit of the evening listening over the radio, and then maybe what people at KSUN thought, what's next in terms of Long Bay?
Well,
it was a big moment.
Most of the radio traffic was fairly routine. And being a radio operator 90% of the time is quite a boring job. You did have the advantage, though, of being in the midst of the nerve center of the battalion or the company, and you always knew what was going to happen. When Long Bay was hit, I had a feeling then that, is it going to happen or isn't it going to happen? And then I guess when it did happen, it gave me a little bit more confidence in our intelligence, knowing that maybe they did know what was going on. But I think it also impressed upon me that that was a real fight that was going on, too. And of course, after that, we got word several times that this looked like the night that something was going to happen. And to us, it never really happened. We had that word numerous times, and I guess that's why by the time I talked to that reporter from Long Island, I had the feeling that nothing was going to happen. But I don't know of many Marines on that hill that even if it had turned into another DMV and food, didn't feel like we couldn't hold our position. I know a lot of us were worried when we first got there, myself included, but as the buildup continued, we were there and we intended to stay till it was over with. So that reminds me of the other incident similar to Alf that I wanted to tell you about, too. This was before we left the hill. Bravo had an outpost also that had a very similar occurrence happen. It was only an OP, though. It was only posted during daylight hours. And it was out in the same general direction as that outpost that Alpha had. And we posted with generally about half a dozen men during the day. And when they went out at first light, and I was on watch when they went out each morning. And I don't remember exactly when this happened. It was well after Bravo's outpost was overrun, though. They went out that morning. They checked with me when they went out the wire, and then they would always check with me when they set in. And a few minutes after they went out the wire, this was probably 300-350 meters out from inside the wire, this hill. And wasn't very long after that, I got a call on the radio, and a guy was whispering. He asked me if there were supposed to be any friendly troops on that hill. And I told him, no, there weren't supposed to be. And he started saying something then, and I don't remember what it was. They heard voices or something out there. And the situation was totally covered with fog. NBA evidently had been up there all night digging. And they didn't expect anybody to come out there until the fog burned off, so they weren't. There was no noise discipline at the time, and that's why they heard them going up. But evidently they heard that guy on the radio talking, or somebody else made a noise or something. And while that guy was talking, firing broke out. And I just told him right then to get out of there. And normally a corporal wouldn't make that decision, but the captain was there asleep, And at that time, at the company level, we didn't have a watch officer. But I just told them to get out of there. And we had a fight that went on then for probably another hour, I guess. And I woke up Captain Williams then, and the weapons platoon leader came over. And Captain Williams and another one of the radio operators and I went over to, I guess it must have been 1st Platoon's lines that were over there on the far side of the hill, and they were the ones who sent out the OP. And we went over there, and the OP was below the crest of the hill, and they were taking fire from the NVA on top of it. And I guess in the meantime, the fog had lifted enough, because I remember very distinctly watching it. And we got in the trench line, and our hill on that side of the hill had a very significant slope to it. It was probably 45 degrees on that side. And dumb me, Captain Williams and this other radio operator got right beside an M60. And of course, the NVA had supporting fire from all their mortars out in the hills. And they started firing on that M60 when that M60 started firing on the hill. The rounds never did hit the M60, and they landed in front and behind us, but the slope of the hill was so steep there that the shrapnel just went into the hill. But it was just like sitting there watching a war movie for real, because you could see these six guys out there online throwing grenades and then charging the top of that hill. And the only thing was, they weren't successful, and we had a couple of guys killed and I don't know how many wounded, and we had to send most of the 1st Platoon out there to get them out of there. And my own personal belief is that we had some short rounds from our own 81s when that happened, because our 81s fired, and to the best of my knowledge and memory, NVA mortars weren't firing at that particular time, and two rounds landed down there in the midst of our men and killed a corpsman, and he had a green smoke grenade strapped to his aid bag, and I remember it ignited that smoke grenade. But the incident was just very similar to what happened to Alpha, except we lost a whole lot fewer men in it. And Captain Radcliffe got on the, he was Alpha Company commander, the one I was talking about that was so proficient. He got on the radio at the time, and I remember he made a comment almost verbatim that if Bravo can't take the hill, Alpha will come over and do it. And I lost a little bit of respect for him when he said that. It really wasn't a necessary comment. But when we got on Pegasus, back to Pegasus now, when we got off on Pegasus, we were patrolling this area trying to clear it out. And we ran into a few NVA. In fact, that AK that I'm holding right there.
Excuse me, Rick. Mitch, is that almost done, or how are we doing?
Yes.
When we
Pegasus. I think they actually left people as a rear guard, is what it amounted to. We ran into just a few of them. That particular AK right there, the day before, had killed a Marine and wounded two others. We were just moving through an area trying to clear it, and an NVA popped out of a spider hole and just sprayed an area. And he was killed practically immediately, but that one burst of fire killed one Marine, and that guy had, I guess, about 2 weeks left in country and a wife and a child at home. And this AK, though, that saddle between the two hills I was talking about had a path running along it, which evidently was broken by the NVA. But we carried that myself and two or three other guys just one afternoon off that path over to the other hill, and it was probably 700-800 yards, I guess, over there, and turned in the AK to ST and walked back. Had I known then what I knew a few days later, I wouldn't even have thought about doing that, but we had been in platoon strength probably on that path and never saw anything, so we decided we'd chance it, and luckily nothing happened. Alpha Company, and I had two very good friends in Alpha Company who managed to survive this, one wounded and one not. Back to you. The one who was not lives in Detroit, and I visited him a couple of years ago up there. Alpha Company ran head-on into an NVA ambush. And this was mid-morning one day. And this friend of mine had an NVA grenade bounce off his radio and not detonate. This other fella got some shrapnel. I remember he got some above his eye, in his arm. And maybe that was all. He wasn't hurt badly, and he came back to us later. Alpha had a number of people killed, and they could not get out of it. And Platoon Charlie went out there. And another platoon from Charlie. And there were more people killed. And they couldn't get out of it. And finally, Delta went out there and helped them. And they got out of there. But they left 38 bodies laying out there. None of this is covered in Shore's book. He stops before all this happens.
Where is this in the map? Where are we talking about? Why don't you repeat that, you know, when you